Hey everyone, welcome to the 443 Security Simplified Podcast. I'm your stand-in host, Corey Knockreiner, and joining me today is...
Trevor Collins.
On today's episode, we cover the latest InfoSec news, including AI-generated blog posts that are convincing enough to appear on security sites, a peer-to-peer botnet targeting SSH servers, and more. So it's going to be a fun ride. Before we start, you've surely noticed our missing host, Mark Liliberty, is enjoying some well-earned time off right now. I'm filling in for his hosting duties this week, and I'm also happy to introduce another Threat Lab analyst from our team. Why don't you introduce yourself, Trevor?
Thanks, Corey. I'm Trevor Collins. I'm part of the Threat Lab, so I work with Mark and Corey. And part of my duties is essentially to maintain the backend database, you know, for the threat landscape on Sicplicity.com. I also do different projects. Like, if I recall, you guys were talking about the face recognition analysis, you know, between the biases and gender. And so that's one of the projects that I did, and a couple other things here and there that you'll see on Sicplicity.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, Trevor. I think we just brought up that facial recognition. So hopefully a lot of our audience have already heard your name since we brought you up before. By the way, it's kind of a 443 tradition, not only for our guests, but me and Mark did it in our first episodes, to ask you your hacker origin story. And by the way, in this case, by hacker, we don't necessarily mean the criminal one. It's just kind of a kudos to security pros. So do you have a hacker origin story, Trevor? How did you get interest in cybersecurity?
A lot of it kind of came naturally. You know, when I was younger, I worked on computers, got to play with my friends to get by getting the networks connected to different computers. And eventually, you know, decided it's kind of doing other things, and then finally decided that I would study Cisco. So I went in and got some information on Cisco, got, you know, certified on it, and then naturally went into security and started in support at WatchGuard. And after that, after working on that support for a little bit, I got where I am here.
Awesome. Yeah, a lot of us really have a love for technology, and that's what gets us into it once we realize how you can also kind of exploit technology to do things it's not entirely always meant for. So interesting. But with that out of the way, why don't we go ahead and dive right into this week's news? This week, Trevor and I have three stories for you, starting with an AI-generated blog that actually fooled security pros, or at least a security site. So let's dive into the story, Trevor. I think it's good to probably start to talk about AI-generated media is something that we've talked a lot about on the 443 podcast. You've heard us talk about deepfakes, which is where people can use machine learning to make fake images where they put your head on someone else's body. They've applied it to video. There's a lot of deepfake video going on right now where you can put your face on just about anyone. Another popular thing is audio deepfakes. There's a particular company called Lyrebird, spelled L-Y-R-E bird, which if they can get 30 seconds of anyone speaking, they can use machine learning to take that voice and have it say whatever they want. So, and really, these deepfakes are very interesting. It's interesting to see how artificial intelligence and machine learning is being used to kind of copy and mimic us. So, very interesting thing that's been happening. The latest story around this, though, is recently a college researcher named, I hope I don't horribly hurt his pronunciation, Liam Poor, who's actually a Berkeley College student, recently leveraged a generative deep learning language model from a company called OpenAI. And the model is called Generative Pre-Training Transformer 3, which we're just going to shorten to GPT-3. And this is basically kind of a natural language processing model. One of the things deep learning, machine learning, all these AI-like technologies have been used for is to try to create a speech, text, whatever, that sounds like a human, that's like natural language speaking. And GPT-3 is essentially a model that if you give it a bit of information, it can spit out a lot of text that seems to come from a human.
One thing about the GPT-3 that actually differs a lot from the video, from the, like the deep fakes and the deep audio fakes, is that you're, instead of giving it a lot of information for it to then train on to create a fake image, all you're doing in this scenario, you know, what Liam Poor did is give it like a title, and then it's able to write the entire story, or write a, you know, in other cases, it writes a poem. And so it's not just, it's taking a little bit of information and almost creating its own data, its own stories in this case.
Yeah, essentially, he created a script that includes that kind of introduction headline for what he wants GPT-3 to create some text for. And I think he gave it a little bit of an introduction too. So there is some human seed of that he's giving it to kind of give it a topic to start to eloquently talk about. But then essentially GPT, this model, will spit out a whole blog post or article or whatever you want. Another interesting thing, by the way, so what he did, just so you know, OpenAI is a company that has this GPT-3 model, and they've had all kinds of different deep learning and machine learning models, some that they've actually in the past openly shared publicly as part of kind of research and sharing to for people to learn about machine learning and AI. But a couple times they've realized that some of their models are very powerful. We'll get into this a little later, but there's obviously potentially malicious uses for anything that can fake a human being in any sort of form of media, video, audio, or whatever. In this case, GPT-3 is not open to the public, but it is open kind of as a beta to researchers. They allow colleges and other researchers to kind of request access to it after some sort of validation and curation. So what Poor basically did, he is a Berkeley student again, but he wanted to play with this model for his particular experiment. He didn't actually apply himself. He found Berkeley, of course, has a lot of artificial intelligence research. He found a fellow PhD candidate student who already had access to it and was willing to collaborate. And essentially, in about 3 hours, once he had access to this tool, he was able to create this simple script that with just a little bit of a headline and intro could create a blog post. And what he did as his experiment was he basically created a blog that was entirely AI generated. We'll share the link to the blog in the show notes, but he created the blog under a alias Adolos, and it has a number of different posts. All kinds of random posts, by the way, not cybersecurity related per se, some were about productivity and other things. But one of the interesting things about this was some of his posts, and specifically his first real post about productivity, was picked up by some popular cybersecurity sites, specifically Hacker News, and it showed up in one of their news feeds. And as he expected, as people looked at this, this blog post kind of passed for a human post. I believe some commenters did read the article and did suggest, hey, I'm not sure if this is real or not. But those users were downvoted, and other commenters thought it was totally specific. So it's very interesting. You know, one of the things we talk about in computer science and even security is the Turing test. And essentially, this is to try to create an artificial intelligence or a program or code that can convince another human being that it's also a human being. So anytime you have writing that convinces other human beings that it actually came from a human, pretty interesting situation, don't you think, Trevor?
Absolutely. And on part of the reason that he did the productivity by Adolos, which actually, by the way, it's kind of funny, the Dolos is the god of trickery, and then he put an A in front of that. I thought that was kind of interesting. But part of the reason that he did that for productivity is it's these articles are not as technical, so you can write about it and kind of be a little bit more abstract, which is what the GPT-3 is very good at. When it comes down to like the math problems and stuff like that, it actually has been able, it has shown that it can have some intelligence when it comes to math problems. So you have a the data that it's trained on. And even if that data doesn't include, you know, 121 plus 121, it'll still be able to add those two numbers together most of the time and get a correct answer. So it's learning. It's becoming almost human, but, you know, still has a long ways to go.
I think your point is it's more comfortable. It's more convincing when it's speaking generally. If you get in something like information security, besides just the math, there's a lot of very specific lingo, a lot of ways that information security use exact technical language in a different way that just humans speak generically about a topic. And he probably knew that if you go that direction, it would be less convincing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so he's doing these articles, and, you know, that's his first post, which was about how to be more productive and not overthink, is, you know, all about the productivity, and that's the one that got on the top of Hacker News.
Yeah. Anecdotally, just to talk about how maybe these AIs aren't able to be super technical yet in their writing and speech patterns, I wish I had looked up the author of it, but we did talk about it on a podcast long ago. It wasn't this year's Black Hat, but Mark and I, quite a few years, at least a year, if not 2 years ago, attended a Black Hat subject where the researcher... he is basically, I believe it might have even been a journalist. What he was doing was he is trying to out this kind of scam organization that would pretend to be a technical organization that was being a technical conference. And it would ask people to submit calls for papers where they could speak at the conference, but they had to pay to speak. So you had to pay to get your technical abstract considered. And they would then let you speak as though you're speaking to other peers in your field about some scientific research, technology, or whatever. But what this journalist knew was it was all, they really just wanted these people to pay. They would end up going to conferences where no one was there. And really, it was just a scam to get you to pay to go because you wanted to speak in front of a crowd. But anyways, the reason I bring this up is part of their joking way of doing research here was they used some open source artificial intelligence or machine learning writing things. And what they did, it was not GPT-3, by the way, but it was an older one. But they did a technical abstract for, a cybersecurity research talk. But what was hilarious and part of their point was the technical abstract, we took an example of one and they read it in the crowd. It was just ludicrous bullcrap. It was so obvious it was not a human writing it, and it knew nothing about cybersecurity. And that was kind of what's funny about it. And it kind of proved this was a scam, because the truth is the people that put on this so-called conference didn't really care what the talk was about. They just wanted you to pay. But anyways, I thought that's a good example of how it can't write. You know, machine learning is getting better. It's getting better at writing as a human. But when you give it the kind of seed to do a technical writing, that's where it seems to fall down and can be pretty funny rather than convincing.
Yeah, you see basically the emails like that, you know, the scam emails about whatever, buy this product. And I've seen other things similar. And there was actually a program that somebody used that had different phrases linked together, and then depending on which phrase you use, you could then attach another phrase. It was a complicated list of phrases that you could just randomly add together to create different emails. I thought, you know, this is when it comes to the GPT-3, this is actual the learning. So they have basically in this version 175 billion like connections, and they're having it, and by connecting all of these, it creates, you know, the mini brain, and you're having this Azure cloud is where it's located, learning all of the input that it gets trained on, and then it outputs whatever API you need. Then you give it that information to provide the poem or the article, or in some cases you can even have it write HTML script, you know, have like different tables.
Yeah. So to some extent, it's even like the simple fishing where they have hundreds of phrases that they're just putting together. But if you only have hundreds, you don't generate something that's convincing enough. But by this, between one, just having so many options and connections as you put them, plus having the statistical machine learning, the math of learning of how those different connections can be put together in a way that creates a convincing sentence to a human, that's what makes GPT-3 a lot different than just some of the simple kind of automated scripts that a Fisher has used that were less convincing in the past.
Right. Right, absolutely. And one thing to consider is, like, you definitely can use this for malicious purposes. You know, if you start writing articles and putting out biased fake news and stuff like that, you know, we're still not there quite yet, because this is a $4.6 million computer that's able to make, you know, anything. I think people have calculated that just the amount of memory, you'll have to have almost a terabyte of memory to run this thing, and, you know, the amount of processors is astronomical. But eventually, the idea is that this isn't Moore's law, but every 16 months or so, the AI has been able to double in productivity. So, you know, after 16 months, you know, 5 years, you might get down to something where, you know, a business can afford something similar to GPT-3. So it's still a few years away, but definitely something to think about in the future, you know, maybe next election cycle.
Yeah, no, that's really the discussion point we wanted to get to. This can be maliciously used. This story is kind of a hint that it's getting good enough that it's getting better. But like you say, I think we've perfectly talked about where it does fall down. Even when you get to advanced ones like GPT, it's not quite there yet, but it's getting there. But that brings us to how we end this. And I frankly, Trevor, don't know if either of us have a great answer for this, but it's worth asking. As this gets better, and even a year from now, if it starts to get even more convincing, how can normal people recognize a fake written content from an AI versus a human? We've talked about, you know, some of those ways today. Like, for instance, you mentioned when it gets to technical writing, when it gets to where it's not just writing, but it's kind of logic, or where your sentence includes logic. You know, you're talking about numbers, and then you have to also conclude with a takeaway based on those numbers. There's logic and math that a human's doing as he's writing that sentence. They're getting better at that sort of thing, but they may not be great at talking about specifically computer security, because it's very technical, or IT or other things. But so one way is to kind of look for that kind of writing and where it falls down. But do you have any thoughts on how a human, a normal person, might today help recognize fake content from AI?
Looking over the blog post, you know, that the Adotis wrote, you know, through the AI, is some of them are quite convincing, but then some of them really fall flat. You know, for the blog post, it's kind of on that edge of where you could kind of believe that it's a human being. It's kind of not. If I recall correctly, it was like, when it came down to this version of the, you know, the latest version of the GPT, you could convince most people. It was like 90% or higher that you could convince them. It's something like that. And so it's really going to depend on what type of article is written. And then potentially in the future, I could foresee a battle of one, you know, AI looking at another AI's blog post to see if that's written by an AI.
That's a good point.
You know,
that's actually a great point. We've talked on the podcast about something called adversarial machine learning, where say you have a machine learning algorithm that's doing image recognition. An adversarial machine learning algorithm could look at the inputs and the outputs given to that particular image recognition algorithm, and potentially figure out the features it was using to recognize the image. And by doing that, the adversarial machine learning algorithm could give you, you know, clues to what you have to do to manipulate an image so that it appears like something it's not. A very simple description of that. But I think that's kind of your point, where perhaps machine learning algorithms will have to look at writing, looking for some indicators that it can recognize that another machine learning algorithm is generating it. I could definitely see that happen. I think another simpler thing, too, is we have to validate real sources, right? You know, as you're looking at content, anonymous blogs by some dude named Adelos should be very low priority to you. One issue with this, though, is, you know, I could see a day and age where something says it's from Cory Nachreiner. You know, someone can put up a site from Cory Nachreiner and it can be faked as me. So it's not just checking up on the source, but validating that the source was the creator for that. So I think that's one thing. The second question I have for you, and this is kind of just theoretical and hypothetical, is, do we need to limit AI development and machine learning development? As I mentioned before, OpenAI has sometimes realized that they have such powerful models that could be misused that they've decided not to publicly release them. Meanwhile, by the way, machine learning and AI have a lot of great benefits that can help society. So I just wanted to know, what are your thoughts on that? Is this something that we need to regulate or control some way just to kind of slow it down to make sure that we don't introduce dangers?
Yeah, it's a developing industry for still, you know, I think at our point here, even though this has been going on for the last 10 years or so, I'd say, you know, it's still developing in its infancy. And OpenAI has, I believe, correctly decided that, you know, they really want to check to see what's going to happen as they're releasing their API. They're doing it very slowly. You know, at first they're doing for the researchers, and then they're opening it up to beta and others. But as far as the restrictions for this, it's going to probably be something similar to how we want to restrict encryption. You know, if we try to make any restrictions here, somebody else is going to create it somewhere else. You know, and it's going to be just a delay.
It's a great point. Yeah, and China certainly is not delaying a lot of things like machine learning for facial recognition and stuff.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Good point. And if the OpenAI creates a standard that is able to kind of show how others should follow, then we can at least keep in control of what is happening in the future instead of just having to go underground or, you know, in somewhere that we don't have any control about that are just used by criminals, essentially.
Well, it's an interesting story. And by the way, one last shout out to Poor, the actual researcher who did this. If you do, we'll link his fake blog. But if you go to the fake blog, the latest post is actually a real post written by him. And if you want to hear his thoughts on the dangers of this particular incident and why he did it, it's definitely well worth the read. So let's jump to our next story, which is a new botnet called Fritz Frog. And Fritz Frog is essentially a peer-to-peer botnet that targets SSH servers. So this comes from some research from a company called Guardicore, who, you know, they can monitor traffic and often see bot command and controls and malicious activity. They notice some activity that helped them identify this new botnet. To cover it really quickly, I actually didn't recall why they called it Fritz Frog. Really, the names they use on some of the malware is weird. Sometimes it has to do with some string they found in it. But this is a pretty simple infection vector for this botnet. We'll get into how it's sophisticated at the same time. But really, this is a SSH brute forcer. What this botnet's doing is ultimately, once it infects a computer, it's scanning internet addresses for any server that's has the SSH port, and it's simply trying to brute force the credential of, say, the admin account on the SSH server using a list of common creds. You guys probably remember the Mirai IoT botnet that worked through Telnet. Very common spread to that, except it's SSH. The other difference is the Mirai botnet was using default Telnet passwords in a relatively short list of just 60, later on maybe 100. Fritz Frog has a pretty extensive list of common and default credentials that it goes through. But that said, ultimately, it's just trying to brute force the SSH login. But if it does get onto your SSH server, it then does use admin control. to kind of infect your computer and start spreading as well. Some of the details about this is it's written in a language called Golang, also called Go. For those that don't know, this is kind of a programming language that came out of Google about a decade ago. Very C-like. A couple of the developers there, I think, didn't like C-sharp or C++, so they created their own C-like programming language. Pretty efficient networking capabilities in this language for the nerds, though. Another interesting part about this botnet, and this is where it does get more sophisticated, is it's a living off the land or fileless attack. You know, once it gets onto your SSH server, it's basically using normal commands to filelessly run itself in memory. It is modular, so it has different capabilities depending on the person behind it and what they're doing. An interesting thing is the process is it runs in memory. It doesn't leave a file on your computer, but it uses kind of legit names for the processes. Ifconfig, if you're a Unix or Linux user, you probably know what that is. Nginx, which is spelled N-G-I-N-X. Nginx is a very popular Unix-based kind of proxy web server. These are legit named processes, but in this case, of course, Fritz Frog uses it. So a very interesting botnet. Another interesting thing is, you know, obviously botnets by definition are, the whole goal is for the attacker to infect hundreds of thousands or many, many computers that all share the same command and control channel, and then one threat actor can send commands to all of them at once through this command and control channel. In the past, these used to be kind of IRC based. Nowadays, they use HTTPS, but this one uses peer-to-peer. And it's not the first peer-to-peer botnet. There's been many, but this one uses a very custom peer-to-peer channel that they've developed themselves. Guardicore mentioned that when they first saw this botnet, they weren't sure there was a command and control channel at first, because it took a while to see the peer-to-peer network. I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. This is definitely a new system that it's really fully peer-to-peer control, and it's actually IRC over the peer-to-peer. But in this connection here that's created, it actually, you would think it's, if you compare it to a BitTorrent or something like that, thousands of users or hundreds of thousands of users even, this only actually ended up infecting 500 servers that they know of.
500, yeah, yeah.
So it's a very small...
It's not a huge botnet yet.
It's a very small botnet. But, you know, it's interesting as conceptualized. But in this scenario, you know, I almost feel like it might be the precursor or something like that. But, yeah.
Very likely. I will say, of those 500 affected victims, a lot of big U.S. and EMEA universities, and apparently a railroad company. Not surprising, by the way, because universities are probably a little more promiscuous with things like SSH connections. So that kind of, it doesn't seem to be affecting that many big private companies other than the railroad company. One interesting tidbit about a part of the way they do network communications is, what is interesting is this, you know, this threat does start a listener on your computer on port 1234, but it's a local host listener. And for the technical folks out there, that means it's not actually opening up 1234 to the network. It's up. It's opening up that network service to just the local computer. And really what happens is the attacker, you know, to start some of the peer-to-peer comms to one botnet, connects through the SSH connection that's already established and uses netcat to send commands to that local host on 1234. Kind of technical, but an interesting little tidbit that I haven't seen often. They do at least, you mentioned IRC base, but they do at least use AES to encrypt some of the commands. The things it can do, you know, it has 30 default commands. A lot of it has to do with trying to extract databases on the computer. Some of it has to do with running scripts and executables, just kind of have backdoor control. And the rest is just kind of general administrative commands to query the system and the botnet itself. And it seems like, as you say, it's not huge. It's only 500 victims that we know of so far. And it seems like the main thing that it's being used for right now is Monero. And it does not seem like Guardicore knows much about the threat actors behind it yet. So anyways, I thought it was interesting. Besides being, I think your point about precursor is pretty interesting. Anything else you thought was different about this botnet than anything else?
Yeah, it's nothing significantly different besides, you know, the encrypted peer-to-peer connection on this. And then also the localhost connection using the Netcat, it's interesting, although I think we've seen that, some of that before in other malware. It's really feel like this is a lot of work for them to set up this type of peer-to-peer connection just to try to infect 500 computers and maybe mine some Monero coin. You know, I almost wonder if this is like, if there's some type of version 2.0 that is in the plans, just simply because it seems like a lot of work for this whole protocol to get set up. What are your thoughts on that?
I actually think your precursor idea is interesting. One thing that Guardicore did say is that they've detected 20 different variants of Fritz Frog and that it's modular. And what that tells me is they keep changing things and adjusting. It's probably one threat actor behind it. And they keep changing things and adjusting it to have so many different variants. So this could simply be the experimentation phase we're seeing, where maybe it's a new, a lot of these botnets, you know, they start new and fresh, develop as code frameworks over time, and eventually are leaked or sold to the public. So maybe it is kind of a precursor in showing that someone is starting to sign something new, but it could get bigger in the future. But I did think it was rather interesting. Let's finish off really quick, though, Trevor, with protection tips. What would you suggest folks do to make sure that they don't get Fritz Frog?
Sure. Well, the biggest thing to remember about this is it's a fileless malware. So everything is all in memory. If you have a older antivirus system that doesn't scan your memory, you're never going to find it. So, you know, you definitely want to make sure that you have...
That applies to, you've heard me and Mark talk about proactive malware techniques. Some of them are still file-based. Like when we talk about machine learning-based detection or behavioral detection, some of the machine learning-based detection is still doing that model against a file. And behavioral detection can be both. It can be against files, but it can also be against processes. But my point is that some sophisticated and proactive AV may still not catch this because there is no file involved. Right, Trev?
Absolutely. Yeah, so having something that is able to scan the memory or scan the traffic that's going into your network is going to be far better than just doing a basic hard drive scan, because that's not going to find it. You know,
and I think that the bigger thing is here, like Mirai, this ultimately, the infection vector to this fileless malware is a simple credential attack. So, and in this case, at least so far, it's just SSH focused. So I think the main takeaway and tip here is you don't want stupid default passwords or bad common passwords on your SSH accounts. So use strong passwords. And if there's any way to add multi-factor to things, do that too. You can also use key-based login. SSH allows SSH keys. By the way, one thing we didn't mention is after this attack gains access to your SSH server using a common credential or a default credential, it does set up its own SSH key as an emergency backdoor, just in case you change the password. But that said, you know, forget this malware. You should have some sort of SSH key or something more than just a bad password on your SSH servers, especially if they're exposed to the public.
If the malware uses better passwords and encryption than your server does, then you might want to relook at your password policy. Another thing to look at is when you're investigating to see if maybe it was compromised, is look for the ifconfig or the nginx processes running. Those are both processes that are used by this malware. So, you know, it is possible to have these processes running in the background if you have like a web server. But if you don't have this SSH server and the web server and these processes are running, then that's an indicator of the malware compromising your server.
And by the way, unlike Nginx, which is actually a service that stays on, you guys, if you're a Linux person, you probably use ifconfig all the time. But as you know, it's a runtime process. You run it, it would pop up in your processes and then immediately disappear because you used it and you're done, unless you run it in certain ways. But the point is, it's very unusual to see ifconfig just sitting in your current running processes for a long period of time. So ifconfig just sitting in your PS results right away should be a pretty big takeaway. The final thing to know is if they're doing any Monero mining, because you're a victim of this, there's going to be port 555 activity. So look out for that. So it may not be the hugest thing. There were, by the way, other state-sponsored malware attacks that we saw this week. One was from North Korea, Blinding Can. Another one is state-sponsored Russian malware. I think they called it DrovoRub, which are very interesting. The DrovoRub, by the way, targets Linux servers with a kernel rootkit. So they're cool. We don't have time to cover those, but if you're interested, you should look them up.
I want to add one quick note for the protection tips. It's that at this point here, you know, with the only 500 servers, you're not going to get a lot of noise, a lot of traffic over this. But all peer-to-peer traffic is usually pretty noisy. So if this grows into something bigger, then you can also check to see if there's more traffic on your network, especially, you know, smaller packets, but more amounts would definitely be an indicator. And then and also just go for the Monero, if that takes a lot of CPU, it taxes a lot of the CPU. So if you're at CPU like 90 or above, you'll notice. Yeah. Although I believe this particular malware will check to see your CPU process before the Monero gets installed. So it's going to try and keep it below a certain percentage. But of course, if you're not doing anything and your CPU is at 90%, you might want to investigate why that's happening.
Absolutely. And we have one more story for you, but why don't I hand it off to you, Trevor, to talk about that one.
Thanks, Corey. Yeah, so this particular one I found was about Google shortening the URLs. And so it's not like a URL shortener, like you've heard in the past. This is actually shortening the URLs that just the actual domain is shown in the URL bar. So, you know, when you're looking at something at msn.com, you're actually looking at that domain. But if it had msn.com.attacker.domain.com or .io or, you know, whatever, then it's going to show the attacker.com domain, because that's the top-level domain that you're looking at. And so this is going to be implemented in Chrome 86. So not quite yet. Chrome 86 will come out in October 6th for this. And then additionally, this isn't going to be for everybody. It's only going to be for like a few users.
Yeah, I think they're doing it randomly, where the feature that to shorten the visible URL for the user is going to be available in Chrome 86. But I think they're doing some sort of rolling release where only... It really is randomized, because they're testing whether or not this idea will work or not to some Chrome 86 users. So you may or may not get it in the Chrome 86 install, as I understand.
Right. And I have a feeling it's going to be similar to how they rolled out TLS 1.3 in Chrome, you know, where it just randomly some users gets it implemented, but you can turn it on or turn it off if you really want it to. Yep. So it's going to be... You know, when it comes out, we'll see what happens. Or it could just be like 100 users get in, that's it. You know, so we'll see. You know what? But if you do have like a enterprise device or something like that, that won't ever be.
Yeah, they tend to slow down features for that, because just make sure they test them before they go to the enterprise registered versions or enrolled versions.
Right. Yeah. So you won't have to worry about that now. You know, it's part of this. It's essentially just condensing the domains so that, you know, everything after the domain name, all of the information after that is going to be removed. And then all the information before the domain is going to be removed, from what I understand.
So what they call essentially just the registerable domain, you know, no matter what my website link is, the full URL to a particular path, It's going to be at secplicity.org or watchguard.com. And all you'll see is that registerable part. And by the way, I don't think we've mentioned yet, but the whole point of this is kind of to help normal everyday users recognize phishing.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you see a big long URL and, you know, the domain names at the very end off the screen, you know, you have to scroll over to get to it. How many people do you actually think will do that to look at that domain if it's, you know, that long?
Yeah.
And especially if you see something that's familiar at the beginning, you see the MSN.com or Microsoft.com at the beginning, you'd be like, oh, well, that's Microsoft, you know.
Yeah. So, and that's the trick you alluded to before. You know, the registerable domain, the main domain is the important part, but you can have almost infinite subdomains. So, you know, normally we think www.domain.com. There could actually be www.x.y.z.abc.2.5.domain.com. And they've played with that trickery where sometimes they've done double dot. They've done things to try to make you see just the a legitimate domain when in reality the registerable domain, which has nothing to do with the one you think is legitimate, is the problem. And so long story short, this is really seems like trying to, hey user, this is the only domain you should care about. Which to some extent makes sense, right? I mean, it will make it a little easier to at least have the user figure out what domain they're going to for real. So it's an interesting experiment. What we should discuss is there side effects to this? Is it, I can see it actually helping in that exact use case that we keep mentioning, but are there any downsides you can think of, Trevor?
Yeah, you know, I feel like there are some downsides to this because you're showing the domain, it can still misdirect the users. So if you're familiar, there's SharePoint, Google API, especially recently, have been hit by let me step back a little bit. The Google API SharePoint provides services for people to add a website onto the domain, usually for like logging in or for just some type of information. They're content delivery systems. And so but malicious users can use the trust that people have in those domains and then put a malicious website on it. They quickly get taken down often, but not for a few hours and not after many people have, you know, been compromised. So if they're, you know, able to be good enough to get users to compromise on that website. So if you're only showing the domain, if you're only showing, you know, SharePoint.com or GoogleAPI.com, then users aren't able to figure out that, hey, it's going to this, you know, credentials.php website, you know, or something like that. And so in that case there, it's almost would be detrimental. You know, you would definitely want to see what's happening in the full domain before you go any further.
Yep. Yeah, so I agree with you. I think in some ways, for very non-technical users, it might be a little step, which is why I think Google's experimenting with it and not just releasing it straight out. But I do think it actually is obscuring some of the information some of us more security savvy people use too, especially when the redirection or the malicious link exists on a legitimate domain, which happens all the time. So I think it's a wait and see for this one. It'd be interesting. The good news is, like all their features, they will offer a way to disable this to show the full URL. But I definitely think it's a very interesting thing. We'll see how it goes when they release it.
One note I do remember seeing is that if you bring your mouse over the URL, it'll show the full URL if it is something that you're interested in doing and it you happen to get this feature.
Good to know. Well, that's the news this week, everyone. Thanks for listening. As always, if you enjoyed it, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast. Or as the YouTubers like to say, smash that like button. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at SecAdept, and you can reach our regular host, Mark, at @XORRO_. By the way, Trevor, where can people find you on Twitter?
I am also on Twitter at RENAUNTS, 4, if you wanted to. I don't have a lot there, but you're welcome to follow me.
Of course. And if you just want to reach all of us, feel free to reach us at the hashtag the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to sharing with you again next week.